Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart?
Welcome to the new Young at Heart radio show. I'm your host, Patty Teal. Last week, we played part one of my interview with Dr. Peter Clayton, a well-known psychologist in Santa Barbara who has worked extensively to help people with drug dependencies. So as promised, here's the second and final segment.
I was skeptical when I first heard about methadone. I thought, well, it's another addictive substance. It's just replacing one with another. And that's true. But when you look at the reduction in harm in terms of their physical and mental health and the support that methadone treatment centers can provide, it really, I think, has done a wonderful job.
And Peter, can they eventually get off the methadone?
Some can. I have a client of mine that I work with in private practice now who came through that system. He's in his 60s now. He was a heroin addict very early on in his life as a teenager, and he's been in treatment with methadone for some 25 or 30 years, and he was Hep C positive. He's now being treated for his hepatitis and is now Hep C negative. In other words, he's been cured of hepatitis. The virus is no longer in him, and he's free of methadone. It's been a struggle, and he's still got many issues that I'm helping him with, living clean and sober. But he's an example of somebody who made it despite a whole lifetime of dependency on that drug. And by the way, methadone is about three times more potent than morphine, so it's a very dangerous drug to use if you're not if you don't intend to build up a tolerance to it, but which, by the way, is just to reduce or eliminate craving. It's not to treat anything else except for the desire to get high on an opiate. So we treat the doses can go up to 250 milligrams, which is an enormous dose. 3 milligrams would probably knock you and I out. Mm-hmm. I'd be like 9-10 milligrams of morphine. That would probably even kill us. But some people's tolerance are that high. So we wean them slowly off, sometimes at 1 milligram per week. Sometimes we'll go up and down like a bouncing ball to gradually reducing the dependency on the methadone. And it's carefully monitored by our doctor, Dr. Coons, who's a great physician here in town who works with this population, and he's our medical doctor, I should say, medical director. And so he titrates down for each case is different. We can help people, and our goal is to help people become totally independent of methadone and any other drug.
Right. How do people afford to come in and get the methadone?
The majority of people are now covered by Medi-Cal. So the whole treatment is covered under Medi-Cal. There are a few who are private pay. They pay a small, I think it's, I don't even know what the cost is, maybe $200 a month.
Right.
Something like that, or for the treatment, which is, you know, very small amount, relatively speaking, for the level of treatment they get, you know, including the counseling groups and the daily dose. I guess methadone is a fairly cheap drug to manufacture, thankfully.
Yes.
So those are the two primary ways that people come
into it. Well, it's good that they take Medi-Cal. And is there a detox facility there?
No, their county has a detox facility for all drug addiction, but we don't have an inpatient or, you know, overnight stay or anything, but we just help people through, you know, it's a pretty, you know, somebody comes in and they're already in withdrawal. By the way, they have to test positive for opiates in order to be accepted into the clinic.
Oh.
But that they're in withdrawal, that drug, the methadone, will start working pretty soon after they ingest it. So we can help them through that withdrawal phase. That's one of the things it does. It stops the craving and stops the withdrawal from opiates.
So this clinic specializes in methadone. If somebody has a different kind of an addiction, alcohol or methamphetamine, this would not be the place for them to go. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
The primary reason why people come to us, it has to be for opiate addiction. Now, I have to tell you that many of our patients are polysubstance abusers. They are also addicted to alcohol, to methamphetamine, to cannabis, to cigarettes. I mean, there's very few people that only use one drug and only abuse one drug these days. So polysubstance abuse is really common. So we do treat those other disorders by making referrals out to other clinics and other professionals treating addiction, and we work with them in that area too, because obviously that it's all connected, and we have connections to the self-help programs that are in town as well, of course.
Peter, do you think that Santa Barbara, or you would probably know, has more of a drug problem than a similar cities of the same size?
That's a good question. I was amazed at how many, first of all, if you ever question, do we have a problem in Santa Barbara, I think there's only like 200 AA meetings a week.
Right.
In this town. That says something about the population of the alcoholic or alcohol-dependent individuals. But yeah, I was surprised at how big a problem heroin and opiate addiction was in this town. We have over 300, and it's increasing, by the way, over 300 patients, people who are taking a methadone on a daily basis, and those are the ones who are sought treatment. It's a totally voluntary program. It's not tied into the courts. You can't be mandated to attend the AGES treatment center. So people come there voluntarily.
Right.
So we have over 300. And that's probably the tip of the iceberg of people who have a severe dependency on opiates, and along with the opiates, of course, all those other drugs. So, yeah, there's a huge population. I've been practicing as a therapist with addiction now for over 30 years, and I haven't seen a drop off in the number of people seeking help.
Right, it's very sad. I know my son is in his 30s now, but I remember him telling me that, you know, a lot of high school kids were into heroin, and I was shocked, because I thought, heroin, that, you know, who would do that? And I just think they don't have a clue what they're getting into, and the repercussions, and it's so sad when they get started on such a horrible drug at such a young age.
Right. I mentioned earlier on that there's been a pushback towards heroin, and it's because of the shortage of the what was widely once widely available, which is the prescription opiates. Because the CDC issued warnings to doctors saying, hey, we're getting a lot of people dying from overdoses from prescription opiates, cut back on prescriptions. And so they did, and they've made it very difficult now for doctors to prescribe opiates as they were once doing. And the result is that people have now, those people who became dependent upon, say, OxyContin or hydrocodone, or, you know, that they, these are prescription opiates. Mm-hmm. They have they go to withdrawal. They've turned to heroin to treat their withdrawal. So now you have a return to heroin use, and the needle being the preferred mode for most people. And the other thing, I've been thinking about, why is it that so many people who could never imagine that they would end up doing what they're doing to themselves, destroying mm-hmm. their health, their relationships, their money, economically, their lives. How can people do that, and knowing they're doing? And I believe it's a sad fact, sort of the misuse of our wonderful ability as human beings to adapt. To the adaptability of humans is what's allowed us to reach the stars, well, at least the moon, and to discover what we discover around the world. We're very curious animals, but that adaptability allows us to, in a way, gradually form a relationship with a very dangerous substance like the drugs that we use without realizing the danger we're in. So the most people who start off, say, using heroin don't typically start off putting a needle in their arm. They start off maybe by using another drug first, and then maybe under the influence of that other drug, say alcohol, they'll try smoking a little bit. Mm-hmm. So they gradually adapt to the drug using lifestyle,
yeah.
And then they try that needle. But some of most addicts say, they start off saying, "I'll never put a needle in my arm."
Mm-hmm.
How do they come up? How do they do that? Well, because of this adaptation, it becomes what was once thought of as impossible for them to do. They would never imagine doing it. They end up doing it. And
yeah.
How did I get into that situation?
Right. Right. That's a good explanation. I wanted to ask your opinion before we go about the laws that have changed possession charges of even very serious drugs like heroin to being misdemeanors. And while on the surface that seems like a good thing and people have a problem, I don't think they should have a felony, but it seems like what is happening is people are getting right back out instead of having a chance to sober up, and they're not, in a way, it's kind of hurting them. Because there doesn't seem to be treatment. Do you agree with that, or what's your opinion? You know much more about it than I do.
Well, I don't follow the law. What I know is that, first of all, the human brain doesn't typically discriminate between legal and illegal substances.
Mm-hmm.
So the legality of something doesn't typically work preclude people from using it. Sometimes it makes it more attractive to those high-risk people.
Yeah.
Second thing is my experience with I'm not saying that the drug should be legalized. I think that there's got to be a better way to prevent. If we take away the appetite for drugs, then we'll deal with the problem much more effectively than trying to treat the problem once it's arisen. But going back to the issue of like jail time, people sober up. Sometimes, although they can get drugs in jail, what I've experienced is that as soon as they come back out, they're exposed to that environment. So no matter how long they're in jail and how long they've been sober or clean, they're high risk again because the triggers that they left behind when they went into jail are still there when they come out.
Right. I totally understand. I'm not meaning that they should be punished. That's not the... But sometimes when you can't get somebody into a treatment facility, at least it gives them some time to get sober. And it used to be they'd keep them until they could mandate them into a program. But now it seems like they're in one day and out the next, so they never get a chance to get the help.
They do have the drug diversion programs, and I think that needs to be expanded because they are actually quite effective at reducing the prevalence and incidence of use of drugs. Basically, a drug diversion program says you can go to this program or you can go to jail. If you go to this program, you do well, you can avoid jail time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they test them. In other words, they test the urine to make sure that they are staying clean,
mm-hmm.
and so they have lots of restrictions, but they do actually, they, in a way, coerce people into treatment, and it can be very effective. The problem is, again, that those programs don't work too well for opiate addiction because they require absolute abstinence.
I see.
And they don't allow people to be on methadone in those programs. That's going to change. It has to change, ultimately. You've got to provide this sort of middle step of a prescribed opiate like a methadone.
Right, because people without it, just to go cold turkey, they can't make it, can they? I mean, very often?
That's right, they cannot. And there's another substance I should have mentioned, Suboxone, which is we'll be prescribing at our clinics fairly soon. That is another drug that helps people kick the habit of putting a needle in their arms. It basically blocks the high. And so it's even more effective in some ways than methadone. Because methadone is still a very potent opiate, but Suboxone has a very unusual effect of being something that blocks the high. So the person doesn't feel cravings, but they don't get high on it.
I see. Gosh, you are a wealth of knowledge. I thank you so much, Peter, for being my guest today.
My pleasure.
Okay, thanks, Peter.
Bye for now.
My next guest is Jay Stinnett. He's the group retreat director at Sedona Magua Retreat and also leads the Loving Sober Retreat for Couples in Recovery with his beloved wife, Adele. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you, Patty?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous. Thank you.
Can you tell our listeners what Loving Sober is all about?
Well, sure. Most of us, especially people that are in recovery in one of the 12-step programs, come from families that have, shall we say, an interesting way of approaching relationships. I was raised in a home where my father and my mother both said that honesty was the best policy. But they each had four different really good reasons that they weren't honest with each other. So I observed this and I mirrored this. And so if you asked me if I was being honest in my relationship, I'd say, well, of course I was. This isn't dishonesty. It's just relationship management skills. That would be fine if our partners had the same four things from each of their parents. But of course, theirs is entirely different. You know, my dad wanted to make sure that my mother didn't find out about his girlfriends, etc. So, you know, there was that kind of a management skill going. My wife, her family, entirely different things. So between the two of us, we've got 16 different items that we think we're being honest about, but we're not. Negates any ability to have any true communication.
And intimacy, because it involves being very honest and truthful, doesn't it?
Yes. You know, honesty ends up being about gotcha. I caught you here or I caught you there, instead of coming together and finding a way of communicating from an agreed upon set of definitions, if you will. And what Loving Sober is about, it's about finding a common language in which to express ourselves. The first thing that we work on is courtesy versus rudeness. Now, I had no idea that I was being rude to my wife. I'm not a rude guy at all. Yet, when she's on the telephone, I'd walk in and start talking at her. Anyway, so what we do is we go through a variety of different things, courtesy versus rudeness, honesty versus dishonesty. The things that get very, very interesting is when we start to look at how it is that we take our past and project it into our future and keep ourselves from being present with our beloved. It's just remarkable, just a few very simple techniques, and you can learn how to diffuse many of the ongoing problems that people have in relationship. And this is not about getting your partner to change the way they behave. It's not about partner management. This is about coming together, learning a few simple spiritual principles that allow you to express yourself more lovingly.
So you actually wrote an entire book on this topic, didn't you?
The book is I co-authored with my fabulous wife, Adele, and it is available as a free download on iTunes.
Oh, that's kind
of you. Well, yeah. I mean, it was more important to get it out into consciousness than to try and make it a revenue center.
So this is an audio recording?
Well, no, it's not an audio. It's a free download of a
PDF.
PDF. Mm-hmm. Or it's in iBooks.
We did
the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Or you can actually download it off of the Sedona Magua Retreat website.
Oh, I didn't.
It'll be on the webpage for the Loving Sober Retreat.
And will you tell the listeners again the name of that book?
Loving Sober.
Same as the retreat.
Yes, mm-hmm. A Field Guide to Spiritual Intimacy. My last name is spelled STINNETT.
Yeah, so it's obviously incredible. You get all ages of couples that attend the retreat.
Oh, yeah. One of the things that we like to say is that it's important that one person at least of the couple be involved in one of the 12-step fellowships.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter which one. But,
right. But one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, just because of that's the general language that the conversations are used with.
Mm-hmm. So who influenced you, or did you just kind of have to figure out this process on your own as
you evolved? Actually, no. I'm not that evolved. I wish I was,
believe
me.
I think you are.
um, Actually, there was a teacher by the name of Joel Goldsmith, and one of his students, Barbara Mary Mull, was the person who first came up with the Relationship 101 teaching. Loving Sober is an outgrowth of that. In the beginning, it was kind of gotcha-based. In other words, it was important that we agreed that we were going to go through this process together, and then I would, in honesty, tell you whenever you pushed my buttons, got me going this way or that way, or when I saw that you were being dishonest, then I made sure that you came correct.
Right.
Adele and I, as we went through this process, we realized that this really wasn't allowing folks to grow closer.
Mm-hmm.
And what really allows people to grow closer is self-disclosure. So in other words, instead of me catching you, when we sit down to get in a dialogue about each week's process, I disclose to you where I've been dishonest.
Oh.
Entirely mm-hmm. different. I tell you, I almost fell off my chair the first time my wife said to me, remember those shoes you said I told you that I bought? And I said, yeah. And she goes, well, I also got a watch and a bag.
Oh, how interesting.
And in that, see, it takes all the pressure off. Now I'm able to very easily say, well, I actually didn't come home the other night because I went to a ball game with the guys instead of, well, I was just working late.
So all kinds of discoveries come up, but they're given voluntarily rather than as gotcha.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And so as we go through this process, it's delightful because the home becomes a safer environment than it ever has because we have certain definitions that we've agreed upon, things that probably should have been agreed upon a long, long time ago. Yeah.
That's so interesting. So there's something in the description of the retreat that I want you to explain to me. Mm-hmm. That was so very interesting. I love the wording. The retreat was designed to provide a fresh, joyful way to uncover, discover, and discard the unwelcome yet oh-so-resilient karmic dance that all couples experience and to help you be aware that your partner's your greatest supporter. There's a little more, but the karmic dance, can you explain that?
Well, yeah, the karmic dance, every relationship that I've ever been involved in, about every 6 to 9 weeks, there'd be this blow up. You know, there'd end up being tears and there'd end up being, you know, slamming doors or it'd just get really silent for 2 or 3 days.
That was very dramatic.
And so this is what we call the karmic dance.
Mm-hmm.
And the flashpoints were always very much the same. The last thing that it occurs to me, if I'm paying somebody to come in to clean the house, is that I should clean up before the cleaning lady comes. It doesn't compute. Now, my wife many times would say, well, so-and-so is coming tomorrow, and we've got to pick the house up before.
Mm-hmm.
What I heard was, you got to clean the house before this gal comes.
Mm-hmm.
She was just talking herself about, you know, making sure that things are straightened up so the woman could do her job.
Mm-hmm.
But I would take that personally, and I'd blow up over this on occasion.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so my thought is, she's got to change the way she talks to me mm-hmm. about the cleaning woman.
Mm-hmm.
When all she's doing is just kind of reporting something out loud about what she's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way that we uncover that. Now, that all has to do with being touchy. This is one of the aspects of the loving sober thing. And any time that I see myself being touchy, I need to evaluate what's causing me to do this instead of me trying to figure out how I'm going to re-educate you so that you can not make me upset so I can be happy in my life.
That makes a lot of sense, Jay. So basically, sometimes we're oversensitive, and that would be the same thing as being touchy?
Yeah, oversensitivity.
Yes.
Yeah, that's another way of putting it. And we all got this same kind of basic programming.
Yeah.
So the wonderful things about spiritual truths are they don't conflict with anything,
mm-hmm.
and they're very easy to walk through.
Isn't that funny?
Once we come to find out that my spouse can't make me angry.
Wow, that's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah, I can react to something she may say or do,
mm-hmm.
but within my being, I have the ability not to fly off the handle
mm-hmm.
because it's not personal. she's not doing it to me.
Right.
Which is an odd concept, because mm-hmm. I always thought that she was doing it to me.
Right. If you've just joined us, I'm talking to Jay Stinnett, and he's talking about the Loving Sober Retreat that he and his wife Adele lead at Sedona Mago Retreat, and it's coming up pretty soon, February 12th through the 14th, so it's a great Valentine's Day weekend, isn't it?
Well, yeah. This is a way that you can actually reboot your operating system and learn to have more fun. I mean, we all have kind of the same problems. And so we've got some solutions that are very simple that we teach over the course of the weekend. It's remarkable the way that people are able to change the way they relate to each other.
So if they're interested in this retreat, they would go to SedonaMagoRetreat.org would probably be the simplest way.
Exactly.
And Mago, I always get this, is spelled M-A-G-O, so it's SedonaMagoRetreat.org, and then pull down the programs.
Mm-hmm. And it's part of the Sedona Recovery Series, or you can just /loving-sober.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. The Adventures in Caring Foundation has been pioneering the human side of healthcare for 30 years. That's because when our lives are in the hands of others, we need more than medicine and good medical care. We need to experience compassion, which actively supports healing and is crucial for successful medical outcomes. Adventures in Caring has taught compassion as a skill to thousands of nurses, doctors, and volunteer caregivers. It's so important. We simply cannot afford to assume that it will be picked up somewhere along the way. When the person is treated, as well as the illness, it's impossible to say who benefits more, the patients and frail elderly whose spirits are lifted, or the doctors and nurses who experience compassion by giving it to others. Help us to support the human side of healthcare and to teach the art of caring to our future doctors, nurses, and allied health professionals. To make a donation or to learn more, visit adventuresincaring.org. Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you'll listen again next week. You can always listen to past episodes at youngatheartradio.com, or you can send me an email at senioritirules@gmail.com. I always love to hear your suggestions and ideas for guests on the show. Again, you can reach me at senioritirules@gmail.com. As always, I hope you remain young at heart. Bye now.
Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart?